We have wrapped up Earth Month. Now, recently proposed and passed international regulations around sustainable fashion and greenwashing could bring Earth Day back to its original mission and put a stop to what has been described as corporate hijacking. By 2030, the EU hopes that textile products will be durable and recyclable, free of hazardous substances, and produced with respect for both people and the planet. Fast fashion will be a thing of the past, repair and reuse will replace disposability, and producers will take responsibility for the items they make long after the point of sale. Clothes will no longer be destroyed or incinerated, and landfills will be relieved of usable garments consumers wrongly categorise as waste. As we know, businesses have to take action now or risk fines of hundreds of millions in the future. Welcome to Inside Retail, the podcast brought to you by Edited, the world's leading AI-driven retail intelligence platform. In this podcast, we delve into the current retail landscape, uncovering the opportunities and challenges it's facing, with me, Grace Hill. Today, I'm speaking to Stuart Trevor. Stuart is an icon of the fashion industry, mentored by David Rees, and in 1994, he founded All Saints. And now he's created his namesake brand, the clothing brand that doesn't produce any clothes. It's clear from this conversation that sustainable fashion is not a nice to have for Stuart, it's a mission and a purpose. Stuart explains the real life and often shocking impact that has inspired the Stuart Trevor brand, and why he enjoys the constraints of only using materials that are already available to him. Stuart discusses how brands and retailers must stop overproducing and reconsider their approach to inventory management to avoid the disastrous impacts of dead stock on both profit and the planet. He shares his experiences of designing for longevity, and knowing what he knows now, would he do anything differently? Well, Stuart, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Yeah, great. Yeah, all good.
Amazing.
How are you?
I'm very good. Well, the sun's shining in London, so, you know, can't complain and moan about the weather, which is, such a standard.
We're all coming out of hibernation.
Exactly. So for our listeners, obviously, you've had an incredible career. We would love for you to share with them more around kind of a brief overview of your career highlights and what you've been up to date.
Okay, yeah. So I discovered fashion after I left school. I mean, I kind of was obsessed with it, but didn't know there was a career in it. I ended up at a college studying to be an architect, and then realized on the first day it was a huge mistake. Discovered the fashion department, walked in and felt my heart going, and I was like, I need to be on this course. And I ended up getting on the course that day, and then ended up going on to Nottingham Trent Uni, did a degree in fashion, won all these competitions like the Smirnoff Fashion Awards and Paul Smith Mont Blanc and the Student Menswear Design Awards. And the Smirnoff Awards was televised, and it was on at the Royal Albert Hall, and David Rees saw it, and I ended up poached by David Rees. Paul Smith had offered me a job, but David Rees somehow managed to wangle me into going to work for him. I did 10 years at Rees, and during that time, when I started, it was a suit company that bought in from Italy. And then when I left, I designed a complete collection. We were selling it all over the world. And then I, after 10 years, some of the manufacturers that I'd been working with approached me, and I persuaded them to invest in my own label, my own brand, and that was All Saints. I did about 16 years at All Saints. I launched it as a menswear brand, international wholesale, selling it to Selfridges and Barney's New York and Saks Fifth Avenue and Seibu in Tokyo and all this sort of thing. And after about 5-6 years, we launched retail stores, and it's now basically what you can see. I sold that in 2007. I launched a new brand called Bollingaro Trevor. I ran that for 10 years. I sold that to Middle Eastern Oil Company about 5 or 6 years ago. So, yeah, it sounds like I've had this amazing career. To me, it was a roller coaster ride. It wasn't all easy. There was a lot of ups and downs, and obviously looks to everybody else like, oh wow, what a wonderful life this guy's had. But I've been through all different sort of trials and tribulations to get to where I am now. And now I have a new sustainable brand called Stuart Trevor. I started working with startup brands that have a positive social and environmental impact about 4 years ago. And I met lots of really interesting people that are really knowledgeable. And they kind of taught me about the situation that's going on, because more than any other business, I believe, apart from oil and gas, the fashion business is killing the planet, especially fast fashion. There's 100 to 150 billion garments a year in production. That's like 14, 15, 16 garments per human being made every year. And there's a pile of clothing the height of Mount Everest going into landfill every 7 minutes. I showed that to my daughter. My daughter was like, Dad, you can't lie. I was preparing a deck to show investors. She's like, you can't lie. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, that can't be a fact at Mount Everest, I'm like, well it is a fact. She goes, no, Dad, if that was a fact, every kid, on the planet would stop buying from all these fast fashion companies, because that is horrendous. And I'm like, I showed her where the facts come from. She's like, what are we going to do about it? I said, well, yeah, we're going to launch a clothing company that doesn't produce any clothes. So we launched this business. Those words came to me because I had investors asking me again and again about, why don't you start another brand? I used to love All Saints, but it's kind of mainstream, it's mass market. I used to wear Reese, and then I discovered All Saints, and then I discovered Bolingara. You've been dressing me all your life. Why don't you do another brand? I was like, the last thing the world needs is another clothing brand. But what about a clothing brand that doesn't produce any clothes? So here we are.
Here we are. Well, that was one of the questions that we wanted to ask you, which is, it really piqued my interest, the fact that it is a clothing brand that doesn't produce any clothes. So I guess, could you tell us a little bit more about that? And what does that actually mean in reality?
Yeah, I mean, I know it sounds like an oxymoron or a ridiculous question, but there's actually enough clothing on the planet right now. If we were never to produce another garment for the next six generations, there's enough clothing for us. Everyone has wardrobes full of clothes that they don't wear.
So, Stuart, this may seem like an obvious question, but could you explain to our listeners why there is so much dead stock available? And what gave you the idea to use this as the foundation to your current business?
So when I launched, when I started thinking about what am I going to do, I realized that I have contacts that I've built up over the years. There are warehouses in London, Manchester, Liverpool, all over the country. Some of them are like 50,000, 100,000 square foot, and they are full of dead stock garments.
Wow.
People ask me about how when I started this business, because there's loads of really beautiful vintage American military parkas and flak jackets, bomber jackets. And they're like, surely there's only a few of these left. And no, there are warehouses full of them. And the American military, obviously, they still spend $5 billion a year on clothing. And these kids are in the army for 2 or 3 years, and then the clothes are, they don't chuck them, that somebody buys them and collects them and stores them, and you can get, tons of it. There's also places that do, if I want a size breakdown of Levi jeans or Levi trucker jackets or MA1 bomber jackets, but also dresses. Or there are now, every single day there are container ships full of clothes being shipped from America, Canada, Europe to places like Africa. There are now new setups where there are warehouses in Dubai, Pakistan, where they're taking in hundreds of containers every day and they're sorting it all out. So if I go to them and send them, I would like Rolling Stones t-shirts or Harley Davidson t-shirts, or they will sort out 100 or 500 and pack them up and send them to me. You can pay a premium for them to pick out garments like that, or you can take potluck and get bales at something like, you know, £1, £2, £3 a kilo. There's just so much stock, you wouldn't believe it. So what I do, rather than just a vintage shop, what I do is I take pieces. I do select carefully things that I really like and things that I think are commercial, and I customize them. And we have artists that we collaborate that paint on the back of things. We make patches. We hand print patches and we have them sewn on, or we hand print on the garment. We bead things. We cut them up and join them together. We spray them or garment dye them. We have a chlorine-free bleach that we also do. We just make them more interesting. So basically, we use the clothes as a canvas, and we try and make the most interesting items. We also make things out of, there are millions and millions of meters of dead stock fabric,
yes,
in the world. That, like, little factories that I work with are in the East End of London primarily. They have hundreds of rolls of, you know, 20 meters, 30 meters, 40 meters, 50 meters of fabric. Every time they get an order from someone like Burberry, who ordered, I don't know, 10,000 mats, it's 30,000 meters of cloth that they order from the fabric mill. But the fabric mill has to make 10% over because there's often fabric flaws. So they make 33,000 meters. And quite often there's only one or two rolls that are faulty. And so there's 200 or you know, 300, 400 meters of fabric available. It just sits there. And Burberry were caught out about, and they've now realized that, you know, when they got caught, it really affected their share price. There's legislation coming in. They've all got to comply with, you know, things to make the planet safer and better. You know, I mean, fast fashion is killing the planet. We need to do something about it. So thankfully, there's a lot of people out there that have realized that. And if you look at statistics, recently, vintage clothing and secondhand clothing and marketplaces like, you know, Vinted and Vestiaire, Depop and all that, they're growing dramatically as people start to realize that there's so much out there. They don't need to buy new things. All that, I know it's difficult. A lot of kids, they walk past Primark and they see two T-shirts for £10 or whatever, and it's very easy to walk in and buy them. I went to Ibiza recently with my wife, and we didn't have any shorts, so we went into somewhere and we had a look at nearly 90% of what they've got is made out of polyester.
Yeah.
I mean, polyester is made from petrol, oil and gas. It is, most of the fabrics was really cheap and nasty. You can imagine people buy them and wear them two or three times, wash them, and they end up going off to, you know, they give them to charity shops. The charity shops can't sell them. These container loads of garments that are going to Africa and Indonesia and South America and all that sort of stuff, they're all from the charity shops, garments that no one wants. And they receive them in Africa. They call them dead man's clothing in Africa or whatever, because they think there's so many mountains of it that arrive every single day. The Africans believe, there must be loads of dead people in Europe that because they would never, ever give away any of their clothes.
It's shocking, isn't it? And you see the photos of Ghana, of, you know, these mountains of clothes that, you know, washing up, you know, when the rains hit, it goes to the beaches, it finds itself in the sea. It's shocking.
I think they dump it in the sea. They've got so much coming in. And the biggest problem is that they used to have a thriving garment business.
Yeah.
There used to be factories in these countries and designers and, you know, fabric mills. And all of those businesses have been affected dramatically. The worst thing of all is that the American government, when these African nations asked them, pleaded with them to stop sending them so much stuff, they threatened to cut off any sort of aid unless they accept the waste from the West.
That's shocking.
So it's actually, it's really shocking. I mean, I was shocked There was an article in the Times at the weekend saying Harriet Quick, she's got an article in the Times saying, I've decided I'm no longer buying £4,500 max from the row. I'm going to buy them from Asda for £45. What on earth is she doing? How can you make a beautiful Mac for £45? How much have they paid the worker to make it? Why are they? Why is that on the front of a section in the Times during these times, on the 10th anniversary of the plaza collapsing in Bangladesh? It's abhorrent.
It is abhorrent and dangerous as well to kind of publish things like that. You've kind of very clearly explained for our listeners like why there's so much dead stock, also kind of the vintage and existing clothing that exists. So your brand not only has opportunities through using existing vintage products as a canvas, but also you're creating items from dead stock as well, or fabric. Is that correct?
That's correct. So my mission or our purpose is to make buying sustainable fashion easier and more fun.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to concentrate on the negative sides. We want to talk about how easy it is to produce. You know, I'm a designer. I spent 35 years producing beautiful clothes, working with the best fabric mills in the world and the best factories in the world. And I'm not saying that we should shut all those fabric mills down and we should shut all these factories down and we shouldn't buy anything new. The fashion world and the fashion business is my passion. I love it. Ever since I discovered it when I was 8 years old. And we're never going to stop people buying fashion. That's what you do. If anyone asks you or me or my daughters or my son or my wife, my partner, what do you want for your Christmas? What do you want for your birthday? Nearly everyone it's either trainers or a new jacket or a hoodie or you know, it's clothing quite often. And clothing business is the second biggest business in the world after food. And people used to ask me, why are you so obsessed with fashion? It's not that I'm obsessed with fashion. It is the second biggest business in the world, but it's also the second most important thing that you do when you get up in the morning. What you put inside your body, what you eat, you are what you eat. If you eat healthy, you will live a healthy life. If you wear interesting clothes, you will live an interesting life.
Your brand emphasizes timeless style and quality. How do you balance this with the fast-paced nature of the fashion industry and the excessive consumerism that exists?
So what we're doing right now is trying to educate the youth that fast fashion as it is cannot continue. And we need to do something about it. And hopefully, well, they are listening, because already there are companies like Primark that are working with something like, I think they're now working with something like 2,500, 3,000 farmers in India to get them to grow their cotton organically. Yeah. All of that is great, but unfortunately, you go to these stores, 70-80% of it is still made from polyester.
Yeah.
And I personally have a thing against polyester. I'm allergic to polyester. Actually, most people are. It's not a natural fiber. In the 70s, people used to have polycotton sheets because it was easier. Yeah. You know, you didn't have to iron them. I mean, it's ridiculous who irons their bed sheets.
Who's
anyway,
got the time
it's nice
for that?
To get into crisp cotton sheets on a bed, isn't it? But if I ever sleep in a, you know, some, you end up in some hotel or whatever and you have polycotton sheets, I'm itching.
Yeah.
And my body, I am allergic to polyester. I can't wear it. Most people are. The sportswear industry, I don't understand how it's ended up that, you know, when I was a kid, our uniform for sports day was a rugby shirt made out of cotton. So were the shorts. They were made out of cotton twill. And you ran around in them and you got sweaty and, you know, how long do you exercise for? Even nowadays, if you go for a run, it's what, 45 minutes, an hour tops? Of course, you take it off and you throw it in the wash and it's fine, you know. But they say that sportswear is made because polyester wicks the sweat away. That's bull. It doesn't wick the sweat away. It doesn't absorb the sweat. So your body absorbs it. And the clothes stink and you stink and you have to get in the shower and wash it all off. The only reason, there's one reason why sportswear companies make everything from polyester, it's cheap. That's the only reason. It's cheap and it's in abundance. Well, really, if anybody, if you speak to a professional runner, they will tell you that the best thing, the best top to run in is super fine merino wool or cotton and all that. So I'm kind of like on a mission. Hopefully we will launch a sportswear company that only uses natural fibers like merino wool, cotton, primarily cotton, and Tencel.
So exciting.
Which again is another natural fiber.
Yes. So I guess there's a few questions that have come up from what you've just shared that I'd love to kind of get your take on it. Obviously, you've mentioned kind of the excessive consumerism that still exists. So even where brands and retailers are investing and supporting and educating their supply chain with growing kind of organic cotton, they're still promoting, you know, kind of a culture that, you know, to buy more ultimately. So the EU has developed a strategy for sustainable and circular textiles, but experts say that it's a strong starting point. However, social impact must be the core to sustainability legislation. How, you know, what advice do you have for other brands on how they can approach this challenge?
I think everyone has to look at it. I'm recently started working with some big software companies and tech companies and some of the largest manufacturers in Europe that produce for Canada Goose and Balenciaga and North Face and some of the biggest brands, they have realized that there is, and we see it, there's a downturn in the luxury sector right now. Businesses like Matches, and I mean, it was mismanagement as well, but there is a turn away from luxury goods. And there is a huge increase in people starting to buy within the circular economy, like pre-existing clothes,
vintage, or everyone's
secondhand and all that. It's only going to get more and more. And the clever ones are doing things about it because there is legislation coming and they have to comply. There's a thing called ESG, which is coming in and they have to comply. In the near future, they need to do something about it. And I think it's really important that they start looking at it now, all these brands, I think young brands. I mean, listen, I would love to, as I said before, I'm a designer. I love working with the best fabric mills in the world and creating new stuff. I've set myself a challenge. I only work with pre-existing clothing or pre-existing fabric. So I've been buying dead stock fabric. I've been making it into small runs of garments like the one I'm making. It's a shirt jacket. It's produced in London. Everything's bound, edges. I'm producing it in limited editions, but there are factories in London that I'm working with that and all over the country, and they can produce 2,000 of these a week, 3,000 of these a week. Like there are tailors in the UK. I mean, at the moment, these factories only have, they used to have 30, 40 tailors working in there. They only have about 5, 6, 7 now. If some of these big brands want to move some of their production back to the UK, they should do it now before these, you know, before the talent dries up. Because we need to retrain people to produce things in the UK. With the disaster that is Brexit as well, I think it's the perfect solution is to try and make as much as possible in the UK. So I'm promoting that and I'm trying to make as much as possible in the UK. Little known fact, so the dead stock fabric, the reason there are so many rolls, as I said, there's people like Burberry ordering 30,000 metres and there's 300 metres that they make extra. Every single metre of fabric is examined over a light box. It swirls by and they find like a little mark on it and they tie a little bit of string on the edge of the roll. If the 50-metre roll at the end of it, if it has more than 20 bits of string, then it's considered faulty or damaged and they can't sell it at full price. So there's not, you get a lot of that. So and the saying no strings attached comes from in the old days the tailor would ring up and say, can I have 10 meters of cashmere, no strings attached, because they didn't want anything
I never
faulty.
Knew that
but a lot of people
I had no
that.
Idea you know, in terms of the challenges that you have faced, how do you ensure that sustainability or eco-design doesn't stifle creativity?
Having constraints actually helps you to become more creative. I think even as a young designer, when I started out, before I started out, people like Vivienne Westwood, Catherine Hamnett, Paul Smith. I mean, most designers, they can't even, Alexander McQueen, they couldn't start out by going to the best fabric mills in the world and ordering whatever they wanted. They used to have to work within their means. So quite often they would buy Westwood and McQueen, they would buy furnishing fabrics like, you know, curtains from a wholesaler. So quite often why you would get these beautiful sort of tailoring pieces made from brocade fabrics or velvets with a pattern on it and things like that is because they were using curtain fabric.
Yeah.
They were buying it from, you know, a merchant, a warehouse that held stock. They weren't, so, you know, creativity comes from having constraints. So it's actually, it makes you more creative. For me, I quite like having the constraints. You know, it makes you, instead of just saying, oh yeah, well, I'll have 500 meters of the best fabric in the world from the best fabric mill and we'll put it into a basic coat or whatever, you have to look at what we know. Oh, well, this is what I can get. What can I do with it to make it more interesting? I can add extra buttons or get an artist to paint something on the back, or I can bead it, or I can add trim, or, you know, or make the lining really beautiful, or pipe the seams, or, you know, there's so much you can do. It kind of inspires you having constraints. It's the same in a kitchen, you know, chefs. Obviously, the best chefs in the world can order whatever they want. But when there's now a move towards farm to table and using produce from that's in season from within a 25-mile radius and all that, the restaurants have not got worse.
They thrive.
They've got better.
Yeah,
because you're
yeah.
working within constraints. So there's no excuse at all. I think it's lazy when people say, oh, well, you know, how are we going to do it? Because we're not going to be able to get the best of the best. You know, that's rubbish.
So when it comes to kind of your approach to sustainability now with everything that you have learned in setting up Stuart Trevor, what advice would you give to global brands in taking accountability in the design process and designing for longevity and sustainability?
Well, we're speaking to some of the global brands because they have huge amounts of stock or returns that they don't know what to do with. Hopefully, there's about four of them that we're talking to at the moment, and one or two of them we'll end up doing a collaboration with. That's one of the things that we would really like to do, where we take their returns that are faulty, we cut them up and we join two pieces together, we add something to it, make it more interesting, paint on them, bead them, make something. You know, I think it doesn't have to be with me. I think that all of these brands need to speak to their customers, find out what are their customers doing with their purchases, that, you know, take them, offer them a discount against new stock to send back their pre-loved pieces. You know, people put on weight, people change shape, they change their style, they get married, they're no longer going out, they don't want a shirt with a medallion attached or whatever, they're never going to wear it again. Brands like, you know, All Saints or Reith or, you know, Paul Smith or whoever, big women's wear brands, they should offer to take back stock from their customers that they don't that they no longer wear, and then they can, you know, come to people. There's lots of people. There's not just me that's upcycling things and creating, you know, hidden treasure out of other people's waste. There's a lot of designers out there that can do that. They would all love to collaborate with brands.
Yeah.
So yeah, that would be a great thing.
And where do you see the opportunity with these huge global brands? You know, they're obviously huge engines. They're very busy people. How do you envision them incorporating, you know, repair, upcycle into that process?
I think they have to. It's not a case of how do I envisage it. They're going to have to, because that's what people are going to want. The more people like me that talk to, you know, shout about it and make people aware of what, as I was saying, my daughter, when she saw that statistic about, you know, the mountains of clothing going in, you know, the height of Mount Everest going into landfill.
It's shocking.
And it's all about the younger generation, because that's who buys clothes, really. You know, I mean, people say to me, well, don't be ridiculous. These are kids. They don't have any money. They're 15, 16, 17 years old. Within 5 years, they're going to be earning 40, 50,000 pounds a year. That's how we built All Saints. We inadvertently targeted millennials who were at university by inviting them to launch parties and offering them a free beer. They bought a T-shirt and a Jesus Loves You belt. Within 5 years, 3 to 5 years, they were earning 40, 50 grand a year, the first paycheck, straight into All Saints, leather jackets, all that sort of stuff. These kids are the future. I mean, the worst thing of all is, without naming names, companies like ASOS last year, they turnover 975 million, losses 130 million. I mean, they're buying on a whim, designers that are working for them, and their buyers are just, they don't even go on previous sales. They're always chasing, they're billion-dollar businesses chasing multi-billion-dollar turnover. Mm-hmm. And the same with Nike. Nike did the same. They had $3 billion worth of excess inventory, and their share price tumbled by 30% because they overbought. Yeah. Unfortunately, the pandemic made everybody, they all thought, oh, wow, it's just going to keep going up and up and up. We're going to be multi-billion dollar businesses. We need to buy more stock. Can you imagine 130 million pound losses? How much stock do they have that they don't know what to do with? It is horrific.
It is shocking that, you know, that the inability to forecast and identify the right products and kind of effectively manage their stock position and their inventory to kind of satisfy their customers' demand. It's unbelievable.
I mean, they're not doing the customer any good. They're not doing their own business any good. They're not doing the shareholders any good. And moreover, and most importantly, they're not doing the planet any good. There's no control. And you know, there are companies out there like yours that are helping them analyze. When I owned All Saints and when I was at Rees, I did something that I didn't know I was doing at the time, but they named it reactive buying. Because what I used to do is the factories in, you know, would always say, well, we have minimum order quantities of 1,000 meters or 1,000 garments in knitwear. I would only give them half the order to begin with, and I would get the garments delivered, and then I would analyze what the sales were and then give a repeat order. So I would have to order the minimum order quantity of yarn or fabric, and I would only make the minimum breakdown, size breakdown, so that I had enough to give each store what they needed. And then we would analyze it. We would have merchandisers looking at how many smalls, how many mediums, how many larges, how many extra larges that we sold in Covent Garden, King's Road, Spitalfields, Leeds, Manchester, Birmingham, Nottingham, Glasgow. And we would analyze it all because things are different. And then we would place the repeat order based on what we'd sold so that we were never holding ridiculous amounts of stock. And that was, they called it reactive buying. Part of the reason that we did it is we didn't have any money. So we also couldn't afford to order, you know, huge amounts of stock. So it was kind of like a fiscal thing, but it was also, I was determined back in those days that we wouldn't end up with, loads of stock that we couldn't sell. And then, when it came to the sale period as well, I put in things in place where we would analyze what we'd sold, and it wouldn't be like 60, 70% off or 50% off everything. We would only discount the items that we had extra stock of, so extra smalls and extra larges in colors that hadn't sold, whereas black and gray and off-white. People used to ask me back in those days, why is All Saints? Why is everything black and grey? Well, because that's what sold.
Yeah.
We didn't take chances. We did have items of colour. We'd have small amounts of jackets like this in red, but we'd order tiny quantities of it and they would sell out. And then it would, you know, the store would look like it was all black and grey. But that was because I didn't want to have huge amount of inventory. If you go in other retailers, you would walk in their store and during the sale period, they'd have walls of yellow and green and bright blue because they didn't buy correctly. They didn't. They just guesstimated how many they were going to purchase, and they would order the minimum and they would put it into work, and then they would end up with tons of stock at the end of the season, and then they didn't know what to do with it.
And we all know what happens to it next, sadly.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. There's so many opportunities now in the modern day of how can data and technology support these teams, but also the lessons that you've just shared that I think a lot of brands could really take stock of and take note of as they move forward. Knowing what you know now about where we are today, what would you have done differently when you first started working in the industry, whether that was Reese or launching All Saints back in 1994, when it comes to your approach to your design design process?
I would never have done anything different. I was so great at everything I did. I'm actually amazed every morning I get up and I look at him and I think, this guy's incredible. I don't know. That's a really hypothetical question, isn't it? I mean, I'm happy with everything that I've ever done. I've made mistakes. You have to live with those mistakes and move on. I should never have. At one point in my life, I owned All Saints. I brought in a working partner who was the ex-retail director at Reese. He helped me build all the retail stores. We had 15 stores, including, the last one that I opened, the head office in Spitalfields. And I designed the interiors of the stores, and I brought the sewing machines in
from
a factory in India and created this artwork of, vintage sewing machines. And
wow.
I did all these things, and then I let someone else in the door, and that was a huge mistake. But because they basically put a gun to my head, and I had to sell All Saints to them, and I didn't never intended to. I'd still be there now. But shortly after I sold out in 2007. In 2010, there was that huge financial crash.
Yeah.
I was worried about that in 2007 because we went from 5 million to 8 million to 10 million to 12 million, 40 million, 50. I was like, what am I going to do? By 2011, the people that bought All Saints from me, they borrowed 198 million, spent it, and the crash completely ruined the business. They were bankrupt, and a huge VC bailed them out. If it wasn't for that, the company would have gone under and everybody would have been made redundant. I would have been, if I'd have stayed on there was no way I could have changed that.
Yeah.
Who knows what would have happened? That would have been horrible to have to
go experience through that.
So I'm glad I did what I did.
Yeah.
And I live to I don't know what the saying
to tell the tale.
Live to tell the tale, yeah. And it worked out perfect for me.
Stuart, I think that's all we've really got time for. that has been absolutely fascinating to hear about your story and have this conversation and hear directly from you and your experiences, not only working for the biggest brands, but also in launching your businesses and kind of your mission from a more sustainable future in the industry. So thank you so much for joining us. I've really appreciated it.
Can I mention that check out my website at stuarttrevor.com?
Absolutely.
And follow us on Instagram at stuarttrevorofficial and see what we're doing, because the best is yet to come.
Amazing. Stuart, thank you so, so much. At Edited, we are extremely passionate about the issues that Stuart raised and about helping our customers eliminate waste within their businesses with more accurate planning and decision-making throughout the product lifecycle. Thank you so much for listening to Inside Retail with me, Grace Hill. And for more insights, please head to our resources section on edited.com and follow the podcast so you don't miss an episode.